From Utah Public Radio, this is Undisciplined. I'm Matthew LaPlante. In the immediate wake of the re-election of Donald Trump, the climate writer and podcaster David Roberts wrote that his fellow Americans had elected someone, and here I quote, who is likely to degrade or destroy, whether by malice, misrule, or some combination, many of the things I value about this country. And Roberts went on to say that his heart was clouded with too many kinds of grief to make any sense of anything at that moment. And he concluded that short reflection with two words: maybe later. Well, it's later. Trump is now president of the United States, and Roberts has been carrying on with his work. His newsletter and podcast on clean energy is a regularly updated series of snapshots of where we're at in the effort to slow, stop, and potentially reverse human-caused global warming. And if there's one great indication that this guy is the guy when it comes to clear, insightful, and up-to-date information on the climate crisis, it's that a lot of our past guests on Undisciplined follow him on social media. Over at Blue Sky, where he's been awfully active since the election, he's followed by Samantha Montano and Madeline Ostrander, by Joan Miners and Chris Turner and Neil Grant, all of whom over the years have helped us here on this program make sense of what is happening in our rapidly warming world. And David's opinionated. There's no doubt about that. But as of this moment, that is still an American right. And it's one that not everyone earns by actually knowing what the heck they're talking about. David does. And so today I've asked him to join me to talk about where things stand with a man now in the White House who, in just his first few days in office, had already taken steps to pull the United States out of international climate agreements, to end programs that require automakers to cut greenhouse gas emissions, and to prioritize oil drilling. David Roberts' newsletter and podcast are both called Volts, and you can find them both at volts.wtf. David Roberts, welcome.
Hello, Matthew. Glad to be here.
David, you've said that your reaction to Trump's first election in 2016 was disbelief because you couldn't have imagined it happening. But now, of course, you can imagine it. It's not shocking in that same sort of way. And it feels like you're saying that feeling, that knowledge is actually in some ways worse.
I think so. I don't think I'm alone in this at all. I mean, my sort of attitude in 2016 was, we all know in our heart of hearts that this is ridiculous and terrible, and we're all just being indulgent because we all have our own complaints about Hillary, and everybody sort of likes the novelty of this reality show nonsense, and we're all just kind of flirting with this, even though we all know, even though Donald Trump himself in that race knew that he wasn't going to win, that the whole thing was kind of a prank. Like, in the end, you yell at mom and call her names, but in the end, you know, she's in charge and she'll keep things in order. And your job is just to yell and throw tantrums and be a little baby. And then all of a sudden he won. And it was a surprise to him, surprise to everybody. And my feeling then was just like, we didn't take the danger seriously. We frittered this away. We were not serious.
But at least you could say at that time people didn't know.
It seemed a little like a freak accident, right? And people didn't really know. It's just like people were sick of Democrats telling them to clean their room. And so they just wanted to be rebellious and go smoke cigarettes under the bleachers, you know? So fine. Then we restored sanity and no one cared. No one liked sanity. We started improving the economy. No one knew or cared. We started reducing crime. No one knew or cared. We started reducing illegal immigration. No one knew or cared.
And we passed the most comprehensive climate bill ever.
No one knew or cared. And so to see the fruits of responsible governance and to see Trump's behavior in his term and then to choose eyes wide open the latter is a whole different, to me, it just says that every dysfunction, every sickness of character, of economics, of justice, every sickness facing our country is much, much worse than I thought. I think I'm far from alone in thinking that.
Does it make you question your sanity? Belief in democracy. Well, sanity for sure. But like, I mean, like, so like the New York Times had this interview with Curtis Yarvin, and you know, like Yarvin is famously, you know, pro dictator. And I'm not trying to like draw too close a line here, but like, you know, he doesn't believe that democracy is working right. You don't believe that democracy is working right. I'm not suggesting here at all that you think a better idea would be a dictatorship, but when it comes to this complex thing, thinking about the future of our world generations down the line when the worst effects of climate change are going to impact our grandchildren and their children, you know, we're not making great decisions in the moment, democratically speaking.
Like, this is the United States is sort of the land of the eternal present. But as it happens, these arguments about the best way to construct a society, we've been having these for quite a long time, and we've run through this. Like, yes, the ideal setup would be an enlightened, wise dictator, right? Who made all the good and right decisions, but there's no such person. And if you find some close approximation, his kid is not going to be that person, right? So that's not an option. Democracy is very frustrating and very slow, but works over time better than anything else we know. What we need to do, like where Curtis Yarvin and I disagree, is that I support the unsexy, tedious, long, generational work of slowly improving democracy, because that's all that works. What Curtis Yarvin yearns for is for some authoritarian daddy to come on and make other people stop disagreeing with him. It's a basically adolescent point of view. The reason we need democracy is because you start to realize, like, I'm a grown-up, I'm surrounded by grown-ups, we all have different views about how things work. We all have different views about our values and how things ought to go, and we have to live together. So we're either going to be at war with one another all the time, or we're going to figure out how to live together. And that's what democracy is. It's figuring out how to live together.
You're very much on record as saying, like, people suck at prediction. So, of course, David, I'm going to totally ignore that and ask you to think out loud about the next 4 years. Acknowledging that we suck at this. It is on my mind. It's on your mind. It's clear from your most recent listener mailbag show that it's on your listeners' minds. What are the most likely trajectories for the next 4 years? Like, how bad, in your opinion and estimate, will things get?
Well, the first thing I want to say, like, I hear that question a lot, and it's being asked a lot. But the first thing I want to say is that people, you know, sort of notoriously now, the parties are being divided up. And basically, like, if you're a well-educated urban professional, you're a liberal at this point, you're a Democrat. And in my experience, people like that, of which I am obviously one, so I'm talking about myself here, love words, love talking, love argument, love persuasion, love thinking, philosophizing, think that capturing things in words is a way of controlling them. And I think what they end up finding over and over again is that no, words don't run things. Power runs things. And so what I see in a moment of liberal trauma, like the one we're in right now, is liberals reacting the way they do, which is desperately trying to get their words around it. Desperately trying to sort of capture, like, okay, here's where we are. Here's what the next 4 years are going to be. Here's the kind of period we're in, the kind of thing we're doing. Just as if we can just capture it and describe it well, we can get some control over it, right? This is the liberal, this is the essence of the liberal mindset. And I would just like urge all listeners who want to fight for democracy over the next 4 years to just fight. Right? Like, you don't need to know what's going to happen or even what's really happening on the grand scheme of things to fight, act, do, build and deploy power. That is more important than all our words and all our persuasion in the world. But all that said, the honest answer to that question is that I don't know. No one knows. There is no larger ideological project.
There's a lot of people wondering what's going to happen under Trump to the provisions that have been set forward in that, whether the momentum will continue.
Yeah. Yeah. And there are camps. Well, I would say there's two camps. There's the sort of old school kind of moneyed business guy Republican of kind of an older vintage. And then there's the new MAGA people. And those two camps want different things. Specific to climate and energy, the old school camp just wants to grab the reins of the departments that make the rules and twist the rules to be more advantageous to the businesses that they are allied with. That's the Chris Wright model. That's who's getting energy and EPA and departments like that. And then on the other side, there's the MAGA crowd, which has sort of this ideological commitment to destroying government, destroying the deep state, and really like getting rid of the Department of Education and maybe getting rid of the Department of Energy. And even now, so that faction has somehow talked Trump into, in these executive orders he's issuing on his day one, issued an executive order that said all IRA money stops. We're going to stop sending IRA money out. So, A, it's not clear legally he can do that or exactly what money that does and doesn't apply to. But B, that's a MAGA thing. That's a glassy-eyed ideologue.
Right, because the first camp like benefits from that money continuing to flow. Well, there's a lot of clean energy projects that are happening in red states.
So what the old school Republicans want, the old school just sort of more familiarly corrupt Republicans, is just like, we'll keep the IRA money that's going to stuff we like and that's going to our states, and we'll kill the other IRA money, right? Like, not principled, but also not a sledgehammer, right? Like, we'll just tweak things so they work better for our side. The other side wants to just wipe it all off the map. So the question is just like, is this an area where Trump himself is going to have a preference one way or the other? Or is he just going to do benign neglect and it's just going to be bureaucratic infighting to see who wins? Will he express an opinion? No one knows. But if the MAGA crowd gets a hold of things, then we could really be doing ourselves serious long-term damage. I mean, already we're pulling out of the World Health Organization. We're pulling out of the Paris Agreement. We're killing the EV car subsidies, which means the entire global car market is all moving in one direction. China's already ahead of us, and we're just taking ourselves out of the race. You know, that could do serious long-term damage. So all of this, which is just an incredibly long-winded way of saying it's just too early to tell. Like, there's an element of randomness and chaos here that is just not predictable. I mean, I could tell optimistic stories. All the optimistic stories are basically like, he spends his time elsewhere, right? And there's just not a lot of enough oxygen or time or, you know, whatever left over to do serious damage on the climate front. That's sort of like the best case scenario.
It's hard to find those sort of optimistic stories, particularly if you only look at the federal level. It's kind of hard to imagine things going much worse for people who advocate for the kinds of climate action that you advocate for. But, you know, you had Carolyn Spears on the show recently. She's the executive director at Climate Cabinet, which is trying to move the needle on climate policy at the local level. She kind of calls it like Moneyball for climate action. You and her managed to find some bright spots.
It was pretty slim. Yeah, bright spots like in North Carolina, the Democrats prevented a supermajority. So Republicans still have a majority, still do whatever they want, but they don't have a supermajority anymore. That's the level of good news we're discussing here. But I'll say two things on the optimistic front. One is, in my mind, the two biggest fronts right now on decarbonization, on the stuff I care about, are one, the grid, just like building up, bolstering the grid, improving the operation of the grid, improving the regulations, how the grid works, et cetera, et cetera. And two is housing.
Yeah, you go on this quite a bit. And I think this is really interesting. Like, on the grid, for instance, you've pointed out, or, you know, your theory is, as I understand it, is that it's not like reduced energy consumption that's going to save us. It's kind of the fact that it is increased demand from like from data centers and the electrification of transportation and maybe desalination.
Well, this is what's shaping the politics, I think, in an interesting new way. So before, like for the last several decades, electricity demand in the US has been more or less flat, which means like if you add an energy generator, you take something else off, right? Like for everything you add, you take something off, which creates a certain type of dynamic. But now, in just the past couple of years, you know, people might have heard AI is coming on strong, which means data centers are coming on strong, and data centers are enormous power consumers. And these companies want to build a lot of data centers very quickly. And there just right now isn't enough grid or power to support them.
So whatever is cheaper and easier and faster is going to meet that demand.
There are now companies, very rich, powerful companies like Google and Amazon want more and better grid. You know, so like apart from your feelings about climate change, big money wants more grid. So something is going to happen to make more grid. Like that's how America works. So in that sense, the green folks have a lot of, you know, force and power behind them now. It's sort of forcing the issue. Like we can't not work on the grid. We have to get more power for these things because everybody across the political spectrum views data centers as basically crucial to our future. So there's going to be work on the grid so that can go forward. And then the other side is housing. And this is something which I wish I could persuade all my fellow climate people of, like the worst thing happening right now, not only on climate, but for a bunch of other reasons too, fire risk and politically, there's just a million reasons that it's bad that blue areas, which mean urban areas, are filled with NIMBYs who won't let anyone build anything. So there's not enough housing. So people they want to live in those big blue coastal blue cities, but they can't afford housing. So they're going to Texas, right? So they're going to red states where houses are cheaper. And this is a phenomenon of sufficient scale that it's going to change the number of seats in Congress next time around. Like literally blue states are losing congressional seats because of this population movement, because of the housing crisis. There's not enough housing and it's too hard to build housing. That also has the effect of pushing people out into exurbs, into sprawl, which is very carbon intensive, and it pushes them out next to the urban wildlife boundary where they're at risk of fire and all sorts of other things. So like our economic problems, our climate problems, so many things trace back to the housing crisis.
And you've argued that like urban housing, which is to say that like housing that is done right, or at least in your way of thinking done right, it is an emission reduction technology. If it supports walkability, if it's central to mass transit, if it's dense enough to take advantage of like efficiencies of scale.
But the main effect comes from just physical proximity to the things you need to go to regularly. Like people's carbon emissions are driving around and having infrastructure extended to them. Dense urban housing is a climate solution. Building apartments, that is a climate technology. And that also is a state, mostly a state and local affair, which is just to say that if you really wanted to, and I do, you could get away with the next 4 years having most of your attention on state and local issues. Like if you're a climate inclined person, you can just stay in that pool for the next 4 years. There's lots to take up your time and energy. There'll be a lot of stuff happening. And, you know, you could theoretically just sort of like block out the madness at the federal level. I don't think I'll be totally successful doing that, but that's kind of my goal.
What else do you think is likely to have enough steam right now to survive and maybe even thrive over the next few years under an administration that, at least for now, seems very focused on dismantling a lot of climate progress?
I mean, if you look at the graph of solar, for instance, just to take an example, if you look at the graph of solar energy deployment in the US going back to, I don't know, 1990, it's a pretty steady line upward. You'd be hard pressed to find on that line visually the change in administrations, which is just to say renewable energy is better on a lot of metrics. And over time, in the fullness of time, the transition away from fossil fuels to renewable energy and clean energy is, I think, inevitable. It has been inevitable for some time now. So like the transition is underway. Solar is going to keep growing. Batteries are going to keep getting cheaper and growing. So in some sense, a lot of this just has more momentum than any political administration could do anything about. And it's sort of true on the oil and gas side too. Like one of the sort of surreal things about all this is like right now the US is pumping out more oil and gas than any other country in the world ever in history ever. And in that context, Trump comes in and declares an energy emergency. And he's going to respond to the emergency by finally cranking up our oil and gas production. You know, like everybody in the energy world is just like, what? How? What more could you do? How much more could we pump? Like we're pumping as much as there is demand for, you know, like, and Trump keeps saying, I'm going to lease these vast new lands to the oil companies. And the oil companies are like, well, we kind of got all the land we need. We're pumping out more than we can. You know what I mean? Like the whole industry is just like in absolute boom times. And yet we're having this surreal national sort of hallucination where we're like, oh, Trump, you know, Biden hated oil and gas and Trump loves it. He's going to restore it. It's just like that oil and gas also is more subject to events, to large forces of history than it is to the changes administration to administration. So like the general energy transition will continue. There's lots of money to be made in it. You know, things are going to continue changing. It's just the same story with climate that it's always been from the very beginning, which is that we just don't have time. We just don't have that much time. It's already too hot, getting hotter all the time. We're not moving fast enough. We're not building clean energy fast enough. We're not shutting down dirty energy fast enough. None of it is going fast enough. So, you know, so like the good news is that Trump can't stop that. The power of the US federal government on these things is limited, and the large forces that are operating are going to continue to operate. It's just what we desperately need is someone jamming down the accelerator, and instead he's just going to be sort of riding the brakes.
And one of the things that you often talk about is that we really have to stop hoping for some revolution in human consciousness to fix all this.
And stop believing that being right or righteous matters, gets you anything, ensures any kind of victory ever anywhere. It does not.
And so we're not going to have this kumbaya moment. We're not going to have this moment where people who were right about climate all along are going to be right. It's really going to be about, as you often say, you know, cool people who are doing cool things that seem to have a chance to have an impact on the climate. That's basically what you've built your podcast and your newsletter around.
I mean, climate to me just like is a source of either despair on one side or just a lot of like touchy-feely sort of like moral righteousness on the other side, neither of which interested me in particular. So what happened about halfway through my career around like 2008, 2009 is that the solutions for decarbonization started getting much, much cheaper and much, much more practical. And so the actual work of replacing the old fossil fuel system with a new clean energy system started in earnest. And that is incredibly interesting to me. And I don't know why it's not fascinating to everybody. Like the fossil fuel system is a giant puzzle filled with smaller puzzles. And decarbonizing means solving every single one of those puzzles. And there are thousands of them, thousands. Like I find new puzzles every day that I didn't even know anybody should be working on, much less that there were people working on them. And people are out there now working on those puzzles in a much more sort of practical, focused way that actually produces things. You know what I mean? Like climate was just people waving placards at one another. But here, there are things happening in the world. People are solving these puzzles. There's forward motion. There's a million ways to get involved. A million. Everybody can get involved. Everyone can touch some little piece of it. And that, to me, is a much more compelling message. Let's do something positive and forward looking. Let's build a better world.
That's David Roberts. His newsletter and podcast are both called Volts, and you can find them both at volts.wtf. David Roberts, thank you.
Thank you.
Undisciplined is a production of Utah Public Radio. And if you happen to live in Utah, you can listen to us on UPR every Thursday morning at 10:30. If you miss us then, you can listen to every episode of Undisciplined wherever you get your podcasts. Our program is supported by the College of Humanities and Social Sciences at Utah State University. And of course, from listeners like you, you can support our work at donate.nprstations.org/UPR. Our producer is Reagan Edelman. Our theme music is Little Idea by Benjamin Tissot. And I'm Matthew LaPlante. Thanks for listening. Now go have big ideas.